The Wit of Porpoutuk. Elsu had been a mission girl. Her mother died when she was very small, and one of the sisters, Sister Alberta, had taken her to live with them at Holy Cross Mission. Elsu's Indian blood was not mixed with any other race. Never had the sisters found a girl so easy to teach, and at the same time so full of life. Elsu was quick to learn what the sisters taught her. She had a good mind, but it was her character which was so unusual. She was like fire, a living flame of life. Her personality combined will, sweetness, and daring. Her father was a chief, and his blood was in her. The act of obeying others in the mind of Elsu was a weighing of what was just or unjust. She had a passion for justice in her actions towards others. Perhaps for this reason she did very well in her study of numbers. But she was excellent in other studies too. She learned to read and write English as no girl in the mission had ever learned to do. She led the girls in singing, and she was a fine artist. Had she been born into more favorable circumstances, she would have found her life's work in literature or music. Instead, she was Elsu, daughter of Klakina, a chief, and she lived in the Holy Cross Mission, where there were no artists, but only sisters who were interested in the life of the soul and the heaven that lay beyond the skies. The years passed. She was 8 years old when she entered the mission. When she was 16 and the sisters were planning to send her to the United States to complete her education, a man of her own tribe arrived at Holy Cross and talked with her. Elsu found it difficult to like him. He was dirty. He was rough in his manners, and his hair had never been combed. He looked at her unfavorably and refused to sit down. "Your brother is dead," he said. Elsu was not particularly shocked. She remembered little of her brother. "Your father is an old man and alone," the messenger continued. "His house is large and empty. He would like to hear your voice and to look at you." She remembered her father, Klakina. He was the chief of the village, the friend of the missionaries and the traders, a large man like a giant, with kindly eyes and a masterful manner.
"Tell him that I will come," Elsu answered.
Although the sisters were saddened, Elsu made plans to return. All talking with her was without effect. There was much arguing and weeping. Sister Alberta even revealed to her the plan to send her to the United States. Elsu understood the promise of such a plan, but she shook her head. She was thinking of other things. In her mind, she saw the curve of the Yukon River at Tanana Station, with the St. George Mission on one side and the store on the other. Between them was the Indian village and a large log house where lived an old man, cared for by slaves. All who lived on the Yukon banks for 2,000 miles knew the large log house, the old man, and the slaves. The sisters also knew about the house, with its unending feasting and its fun. So there was weeping at Holy Cross when Elsu departed. There was a great cleaning of the large house when Elsu arrived. Klakina objected to the changes made by his young daughter, but finally he borrowed $1,000 from old Porpoutuk, the richest Indian on the Yukon. Elsu recreated the large house. She gave it a new magnificence, while Klakina continued to welcome his guests with much feasting and merrymaking. All of this was unusual for a Yukon Indian. But Kla Ki Na was an unusual Indian. Because he was a chief and had a lot of money, he was able to do all this. In the early days, he had held a power over his people, and he had profitable business with the white trading companies. Later, with Porputuk, he had found gold on the Koyukuk River. Kla Ki Na was, by training and nature, a chief. Porputuk was a businessman, and Porputuk bought the chief's share of the gold mine. Porputuk was content to work and increase his wealth. Kla Ki Na returned to his large house and proceeded to spend. Porputuk was known as the richest Indian in Alaska. Kla Ki Na was known as the one most like the white man. Porputuk was a moneylender. Kla Ki Na was a fighter and a feaster, happy with wine and song. El-Soo learned about the large house and its manner of life as easily as she had learned about Holy Cross Mission and its manner of life. She did not try to change her father and lead him toward God. It is true she tried to prevent him from drinking too much liquor, but that was to guard his health. The door of the large house was always open and welcome. People came and went. The house was never quiet. The great main room was always ringing with song. At the table sat men from around the world and chiefs from distant tribes. There were Englishmen, traders, officers of the great companies, sailing men from the sea, and hunters and miners from many nations. El-Soo enjoyed this varied companionship. She could speak English as well as she could her native language, and she sang English songs. She knew the Indian customs as well. She knew how to wear the customary Indian dress of the daughter of a chief for special occasions. But usually she dressed as white women dress. She had learned to sew at the mission and combined this skill with her own art. She wore her clothes like a white woman, and she made clothes that could be thus worn. In her manner, she was as unusual as her father, and the rank she occupied was as special as his. She was the one Indian woman who was socially equal with the several white women at Tanana Station. She was the one Indian woman white men asked to marry. El-Soo was beautiful. Not as white women are beautiful, and not as Indian women are beautiful. It was the flame of her that did not depend on the features of her face that was her beauty. In figure and feature, she was an Indian type. She had black hair and golden brown skin. Her eyes were black and bright. The bones of her face were high, but not too broad. Her lips were thin. But overall, and through all, poured the flame of her. There was something that was fire, and that was the soul of her. It lay warm in her eyes. It colored her cheeks. It curled in her lips. And El-Soo had wit. She never used it to hurt others, yet it was quick to search out forgivable weakness. The joy in her mind played like a flame over all near her, and from all near her arose answering joy. Yet she was never the center of attention. This she would not permit. The large house was her father's, and through it to the end moved his figure. He was the master of the feast and the giver of the law. It is true, as strength left him, that she accepted his responsibilities, but in appearance he still ruled. And always through the large house moved the worried figure of Porputuk, who was paying for it all. It was not that he really paid. He figured how much was due him, and year by year he took control of the properties of Kla Ki Na. Porputuk once decided to speak to El-Soo of the wasteful way of life in the large house. It was after he had taken the last of Kla Ki Na's wealth. but he never spoke of it again. El-Su, like her father, was proud and not concerned with money. Porpoisuk continued to lend them money, and they continued to spend it. El-Su had decided upon one thing. Her father should die as he had lived. For him there should be no passing from high to low, no lessening of the feast. When there was famine in the old times, the Indians came in hunger to the large house and went away content. When there was famine and no money, money was borrowed from Porpoisuk, and the Indians again went away content. During this time, old Porpoisuk watched and waited. With every loan of money, he looked at El-Su as if he were possessing her. He felt old desires arising again within him. But El-Su was not interested in old Porpoisuk, nor was she interested in the white men who wanted to marry her, because at Tanana Station was a young man, Akun, of her own blood and tribe and village. He was strong and handsome to her eyes, and a great hunter. Because he had wandered far and much, he was also very poor. He had been to all the unknown places. He had journeyed to the United States. He had crossed the land to Hudson Bay and returned. And, as a seal hunter, he had sailed on a ship to Siberia. When he returned from seeking gold in Klondike, he came to the large house to report to old Klaki Na on all of the world that he had seen. There he first saw El-Su, who had returned 3 years before from the mission. After that, Akun wandered no more. He refused wages of $20 a day on the big steamboats. He hunted some and fished some, but never far from Tanana Station. He was at the large house often and for long times. And El-Su measured him against many men and found him good. He sang songs to her and was full of joy. Soon all Tanana Station knew he loved her, and Porpoisuk just smiled and arranged loans of more money to continue the manner of life at the large house. Then came the death table of Klaki Na. He sat at a feast with death in his throat that could not be washed away with wine. And there was laughing and joking and singing. There were no tears or sighs at the table. It was proper that Klaki Na should die as he had lived, and none knew this better than El-Su. The old crowd was there, as in the old days, 3 sailing men were there, recently returned from a long journey in the Arctic. At Klaki Na's back were 4 old men, all that remained of the slaves of his youth. With tear-filled eyes they attended to his needs. With shaking hands they filled his glass, or struck him on the back when he coughed. It was a wild night. As the hours passed and the fun laughed and roared louder, death moved more strongly in Klaki Na's throat. It was then that he sent for Porpoisuk, and Porpoisuk came in from the frost outside to look unfavorably upon the meat and wine on the table for which he had paid. But as he looked down the length of faces to the far end and saw the face of El-Su, a light could be seen glowing in his eyes. Place was made for him at Klaki Na's side, and a glass was put before him. Klaki Na, with his own hands, filled the glass.
"Drink," he cried. "Is it not good?"
And Porpoisuk's eyes watered as he nodded his head and enjoyed his drink.
"When in your own house have you had such drink?"
Klaki Na demanded.
"I will not deny that the drink is good to this old throat of mine," Porpoisuk answered. He then hesitated to find the words to complete the thought.
But it costs too much.
Clakina roared, completing it for him. Porpoichuk was angered by the laughing voices around the table. His eyes assumed an evil look.
We were boys together of the same age, he said. In your throat is death. I am still alive and strong.
A threatening murmur arose from the company. Clakina coughed, and the old slaves hit him between the shoulders. He struggled for breath and waved his hand to quiet the threatening murmur.
You have hated even the fire in your house because the wood costs too much, he cried. You have hated life. To live costs too much. And you have refused to pay the price. Your life has been like a cabin where the fire is dead and there are no blankets on the floor.
He signaled a slave to fill his glass, which he held high.
But I have lived, and I have been warm with life, as you have never been warm. It is true you shall live long, but the longest nights are the cold nights when a man trembles and lies without sleep. My nights have been short, but I have slept warm.
He emptied the glass. The shaking hand of a slave failed to catch it as it fell to the floor. Clakina sank back, watching the upturned glasses at the lips of the drinkers. His own lips were smiling slightly as the company expressed its pleasure at his words. At a sign, two slaves attempted to help him sit straight again, but they were weak, and the four old men shook as they helped him to move forward in his chair.
But the manner of life is not important tonight, he continued. We have other business, Porpoichuk, you and I. I owe you money. How much is that?
Porpoichuk searched in his pocket and brought forth a note. He drank from his glass and began.
Here's a note of August 1889 for $300. The note of the next year is for $500. This note was included in the note of 2 months later for $1,000. Then there is the note...
Don't speak of the many notes,
Clakina cried.
They make my head turn around, the whole thing. How much is it?
Porpoichuk glanced at his papers.
$15,967.75,
he read carefully.
Make it $16,000. Make it $16,000.
Clakina said grandly.
Odd numbers are always a worry. And now, it is for this that I have sent for you. Write a new note for $16,000, which I shall sign. I have not thought about your price for lending me the money. Make it as large as you wish, and make it payable in the next world. When I shall meet you by the fire of the great father of all Indians, then the note will be paid. This, I promise you, it is the word of Clakina.
Porpoichuk looked puzzled. Loud laughing began and continued until it shook the room. Clakina raised his hands.
No, he cried. It is not a joke. I speak honestly. It was for this purpose that I sent for you, poor Potuk. Write the note.
I have no business with the next world,
Porpoisuk answered slowly.
Do you not plan to meet me before the Great Father?
Clarkina demanded.
Then he added, I shall surely be there.
I have no business with the next world,
Porpoisuk repeated. The man who was near death looked at him with surprise.
I know nothing of the next world, Porpoisuk explained. I do business in this world.
Clarkina understood immediately. This is a result of sleeping in the cold at night, he laughed.
He thought for a moment. Then he said,
It is in this world that you must be paid. There remains to me this house. Take it, and the debt will be settled.
It is an old house, and not worth the money you owe me,
Porpoisuk answered.
There are my gold mines.
They have never paid well,
was the reply.
There is my share in the steamboat, Koyukuk. I own half of it.
She is at the bottom of the Yukon River.
Clarkina seemed surprised.
Oh, that is true. I forgot. It happened last spring when the ice melted.
He thought for a while. The glasses went untasted, and all the company waited for his next words.
Then it would seem I owe you a sum of money which I cannot pay in this world.
Porpoisuk nodded and glanced toward the end of the table.
Then it would seem that you, Porpoisuk, are not a good businessman,
Clarkina said cleverly. Porpoisuk answered in a firm voice,
No, there is something yet unmentioned.
What? Cried Clarkina. Do I still have property? Name it, and it is yours. The debt is no more.
There it is.
Porpoisuk pointed at El Su. Clarkina could not understand. He looked down the length of the table and wiped his eyes. Then he looked again.
Your daughter, El Su. Her I will take, and the debt is no more. I will burn the note there in the fire.
Clarkina began to shake from laughing.
Oh, that is really a joke. And with your cold bed and daughters old enough to be the mother of El Su.
He began to cough, and the old slave struck him on the back. He began again and started coughing. Porpoisuk waited patiently, drinking from his glass and studying the double row of faces along the table.
It is no joke, he said finally. My speech is well meant.
Clarkina became quiet and looked at him. Then he reached for his glass but could not touch it. A slave passed it to him. He threw the glass and the liquor into the face of Porpoisuk.
Put him outside!
Clarkina shouted to the waiting guests at the table who were straining like dogs in harness.
And roll him in the snow!
The crowd rushed past him out the doors. He signaled to the slaves, and the four old men supported him on his feet as he met the returning company and greeted them for the last time with raised glass. It did not take long to settle the affairs of Clarkina.
Tommy, the little Englishman who worked at the store, was asked by El Su to help. Nothing remained but debts. All the notes were held by Porputuk. All the properties had been given to Porputuk in return for borrowed money. The winter passed. The debt owed to Porputuk remained unpaid. He saw El Su often, and explained to her as he had explained to her father the manner in which the debt could be settled. Also he brought with him old men of the tribe, who told her that her father would not rest if the debt were not paid. One day, after such a discussion, El Su made a final announcement to Porputuk.
"I shall tell you two things," she said. "First, I shall not be your wife. Will you remember that? Second, you shall be paid the last cent of the $16,000.
$15,967.75, Porputuk corrected.
"My father said $16,000,
was her reply.
"You shall be paid."
"How?"
"I do not know how, but I shall discover how to do it. Now go and trouble me no more. If you do,"
she hesitated to find a proper threat,
"if you do, I shall have you rolled in the snow again as soon as the first snow falls."
This was still early in April, and a little later El Su announced a plan that surprised the country. News of the plan traveled up and down the Yukon, and was carried from camp to camp. It was said that in June, when the fish began to swim up the river, El Su, daughter of Klakina, would sell herself to pay the debt owed to Porputuk. The attempts made to stop her were without success. The missionaries at St. George Mission argued with her, but she replied,
"Only the debts to God are settled in the next world. The debts of men are of this world, and in this world they are settled."
Akun talked with her, but she replied,
"I do love you, Akun, but honor is greater than love."
Sister Alberta journeyed the many miles from Holy Cross Mission on the first steamboat to sail after the ice had gone, but she had no better luck in changing El Su's mind.
"My father wanders after death," said El Su, "and he will continue to wander, with no peace, until the debt is paid. Then, and not until then, may he go to the house of the Great Father."
"Do you believe this?"
Sister Alberta asked.
"I do not know," El Su answered. "It was my father's belief."
Sister Alberta shook her head in despair.
"Who knows if the things we believe are true?"
El Su continued.
"Why not? The next world to you may be heaven because you have believed in heaven. To my father, the next world may be a large house where he will sit always at tables feasting with God."
"And you?"
Sister Alberta asked.
"What is your next world?"
El Su hesitated for a moment.
"I should like a little of both," she said. "I should like to seek your face as well as the face of my father."
The day of the sale arrived. Tanana Station was crowded with people. As was their custom, the tribes had gathered to await the coming of the fish. During the time they were waiting, they danced and traded and talked. Then there was the ordinary gathering of white adventurers, traders, and miners. In addition, a large number of white men had come because they were curious or interested in the affair. The fish were late coming up the river that year. This delay increased the interest. Then, on the day of the sale, the situation was made worse by Akun. He made a public announcement that the man who bought El Su would immediately die. He held a gun in his hand to indicate the manner of death. El-Su was angered by his action, but he refused to speak with her. The first fish was caught at 10 o'clock in the evening, and at midnight the sale began. It occurred on the top of the high bank beside the Yukon. A great crowd gathered around the table and the two chairs that stood near the edge of the bank. At the front of the crowd were many white men and several chiefs. There, too, stood Akun. Tommy, at El-Su's request, managed the sale, but she made the opening speech and described what was to be sold. She was wearing her native dress, the dress of a chief's daughter. She stood on a chair so that she might be seen by everyone.
"Who will buy a wife?" she asked. "Look at me. I am 20 years old and a maid. I will be a good wife to the man who buys me. If he is a white man, I shall dress in the fashion of white women. If he is an Indian, I shall dress as an Indian. I can make my own clothes, and sew and wash. I was taught for 8 years to do these things at Holy Cross Mission. I can read and write English. I know music. I shall be sold to the one who offers the most money, and for him I will prepare a paper saying that he has bought me. I forgot to say that I can sing very well, and that I have never been sick in my life. I weigh 132 pounds. My father is dead, and I have no other family. Who wants me?"
She looked over the crowd and stepped down. At Tommy's request, she stood upon the chair again while he mounted the second chair and started the bidding. Surrounding El-Su stood the four old slaves of her father. In the front of the crowd were several Indian kings from the upper Yukon. Beside them, sick and weak, were two old miners. Beyond, a half-dozen French-Canadian travelers stood in a group. An Indian from the lands near the coast stood alone. From afar came the cries of the wild birds on their nesting grounds. Other small birds flew overhead, singing. The bidding began slowly. A stranger from Sitka, who had arrived only half an hour before, offered $100 in a confident voice. He looked surprised when Akun turned threateningly toward him with the gun. The bidding was slow. An Indian bid $150, and after some time a gambler raised the bid to $200. El-Su was saddened. Her pride was hurt. There was a murmur from the crowd as Porpoisuk forced his way up to the front.
$500,
he bid in a loud voice, then looked about him proudly to see the effect. He hoped to use his great wealth to stop all bidding. But one of the travelers, looking at El-Su with shining eyes, raised the bid 100.
$700,
Porpoisuk replied immediately. And equally fast came the reply of 800 from the traveler. Porpoisuk tried again.
$1,200,
he shouted. With a look of sadness, the traveler said no more. There was no further bidding. Tommy tried to excite the crowd, but could not raise the bid. El-Su spoke to Porpoisuk.
"It would be wise, Porpoisuk, for you to consider your bid. Have you forgotten what I told you, that I would never marry you?"
"It is a public sale," he answered. "I shall buy you and have a paper to show that you belong to me. I have offered $1,200. Your price is cheap."
"Too cheap," Tommy cried. "Even if I am managing the sale, that does not prevent me from bidding. I will pay $1,300.
$1,400
was Porpoisuk's reply.
I will buy you to be my cousin, Tommy whispered to Elsu. Then he called aloud, 1,500! At 2,000, one of the Indian kings started bidding, and Tommy stopped. For the third time, Porpoise tried to win by using his wealth. He raised the price by $500, but the king's pride was affected, and he answered with a raise of another $500. The price for Elsu was now $3,000. Porpoise made it $3,500, and was surprised when the Indian king raised it $1,000. Porpoise again raised it $500, and again showed surprise when the king raised the price $1,000 more. Porpoise was angered. His pride was hurt. His strength had been questioned. Because to him strength was wealth, he could not appear to be weak before the eyes of the crowd. Elsu was not important to him now. The savings gained from the cold nights of all his years were ready to be spent if necessary. Elsu's price was now 6,000. He made it 7,000. And then, in $1,000 bids, as fast as they could be uttered, her price increased. At $14,000, the two men stopped to breathe. Then, the unexpected happened. In the brief pause that followed, the gambler, who had added his money to that of several of his friends, bid $16,000.
$17,000,
Porpoise said weakly.
$18,000, said the king.
Porpoise gathered his strength.
$20,000.
The gambler stopped bidding. The Indian king raised the price 1,000, and Porpoise answered with another raise. As they bid, Akun soon turned from one to the other, half-threateningly, half-curiously. He seemed to be wondering what manner of man it was that it would be necessary to kill. When the king prepared to make his next bid, Akun moved closer to him. The king first took his gun in his hand, then said,
$23,000.
$24,000,
said Porpoise. He smiled proudly, for he was certain that he had finally defeated the king. The latter moved close to Elsu. He studied her carefully for a long time.
And 500, he said.
25,000,
came Porpoise's raise. The king looked once more and shook his head. He looked again and then said,
And 500.
26,000,
Porpoise shouted. The king shook his head and refused to look at Tommy, who was urging him to bid more. At the same time, Akun had moved close to Porpoise. Elsu's quick eye noticed this. While Tommy begged the Indian king for another bid, she bent and spoke in a low voice in the ear of a slave. The slave went to Akun and spoke in a low voice in his ear. Akun made no sign that he had heard, although Elsu looked at him anxiously.
"Sold!" Tommy's voice could be heard saying. "To Porpoise for $26,000.
Porpoise glanced nervously at Akun. All eyes were upon Akun, but he did nothing.
"Let the scales be brought," said Elsu.
"I shall make payment at my house," said Porpoise.
"Let the scales be brought,"
Elsu repeated.
"Payment shall be made here, where all can see."
So the gold scales were brought while Porpoise went away. He returned with a man at his heels, on whose shoulders was a weight of gold dust in moose-skin bags. Also at Porpoise's back walked another man, with a gun, who looked only at Akun.
"Here are the notes for the debt of $15,967.75,
said Porpoise. Elsu received the notes in her hands and said to Tommy,
"Let the debt be figured as $16,000.
There remains $10,000 to be paid in gold, Tommy said.
Porpoise nodded and opened the mouths of the bags. El Sue, standing on the bank of the river, threw the pieces of paper into the Yukon. The weighing began, but then stopped.
The scales must be set at $17 an ounce,
Porpoise had said to Tommy.
At $16,
El Sue said quickly.
It is the custom to figure gold at 17 for each ounce,
Porpoise replied.
And this is a business affair.
El Sue laughed.
That is a new custom, she said. It began in April. Last year and the years before, it was $16 an ounce. When my father's debt was made, it was $16 for each ounce of gold. Therefore, you shall pay for me at 16 and not at 17.
Porpoise agreed and allowed the weighing to proceed.
Weigh it in 3 piles, Tommy,
she said.
$1,000 here, $3,000 here, and here 6,000.
It was slow work, and while the weighing proceeded, everyone wondered what Ahkoon would do.
He is waiting until the money is paid, one said,
and this opinion was repeated and was accepted. They waited for what Ahkoon would do when the money was paid, and Porpoise's man with the gun waited and looked at Ahkoon. The weighing was finished, and the gold dust lay on the table in 3 dark yellow piles.
Here is a debt of my father to the company. For $3,000,
said El Sue.
Take it, Tommy, for the company. And here are 4 old men, Tommy. You know them. And here is $1,000. Take it, and see that the old men are never hungry and never without tobacco.
Tommy put the gold into separate bags. $6,000 remained on the table. El Sue pushed her hand into the pile. With a sudden turn, she threw the dust into the Yukon in a golden shower. Porpoise seized her hand as she reached a second time into the pile.
It's mine,
she said calmly. Porpoise let her go, but he bit his lip in anger as she continued to throw the gold into the river until none remained. The crowd looked only at Ahkoon. The gun held by Porpoise's man pointed directly at him. But Ahkoon did nothing.
Prepare a paper for the sale,
Porpoise demanded. And Tommy wrote a paper saying that the woman, El Sue, belonged to the man Porpoise. El Sue signed the paper, and Porpoise folded it and put it in his pocket. Suddenly his eyes flamed, and in sudden speech he said to El Sue,
But it was not your father's debt, he said. What I paid was the price for you. Your sale is business of today and not of last year and the years before. The ounces I paid for you will buy flour worth $17 today and not 16. I have lost a dollar on each ounce. I have lost $625.
El Sue thought for a moment and saw the error she had made. She smiled, and then she laughed.
You're right,
she laughed.
I made a mistake. But it is too late. You have paid, and the gold is gone. You did not think quickly. It is your loss. Your wit is slow these days, Porpoise. You are getting old.
He did not answer. He glanced anxiously at Ahkoon and was reassured. His lips tightened and his face had a cruel look.
Come,
he said.
We will go to my house.
Do you remember the 2 things I told you before?
El Sue asked, making no movement to accompany him.
My head would be full of things women say if I remember them, he answered.
I told you that you would be paid,
El Sue said carefully.
And I told you that I would never be your wife. That was before the paper was written.
Porpoise fingered the paper inside his pocket.
I have bought you before all the world. You belong to me. You will not deny that you belong to me.
I belong to you,
Elsu said steadily.
I own you.
You own me.
Porpoise's voice rose slightly.
As a dog, I own you.
As a dog, you own me,
Elsu continued calmly.
But Porpoise, you forget the thing I told you. Had any other man bought me, I should have been a good wife to that man. Such was my will. But my will with you was that I should never be your wife. Therefore, I am your dog.
Porpoise knew that he must be careful, and he decided to act in a firm manner.
Then I speak to you not as Elsu, but as a dog, he said, and I tell you to come with me.
He reached for her arm, but she held him away from her.
Not so fast, Porpoise. You buy a dog. The dog runs away. It is your loss. I am your dog. What if I run away?
As the owner of the dog, I shall beat you.
When you catch me.
When I catch you.
Then catch me.
Quickly he reached for her, but she ran from him. She laughed as she circled the table.
Catch her!
Porpoise commanded the Indian with the gun, who stood near her. But as the Indian stretched forth his arm to her, the king struck him under the ear. The gun fell to the ground. Then was Akun's opportunity. His eyes shone, but he did nothing. Porpoise was an old man, but his cold nights had kept him in possession of his activity. He did not circle the table. He leaped across suddenly over the top of the table. Elsu was surprised. She jumped back with a cry of alarm. Porpoise would have caught her had it not been for Tommy. Tommy's leg went out. Porpoise fell forward on the ground. Elsu got her start.
Then catch me!
She laughed over her shoulder as she ran away. She ran lightly and easily, but Porpoise ran like a wild man. He ran faster than she did. In his youth he had been the quickest of all the young men. But Elsu ran from side to side to escape his grasp. With noise and laughing, the great crowd scattered to see the hunt. It led through the Indian camp. Always circling, Elsu and Porpoise appeared and disappeared among the tents. Elsu seemed to balance herself against the air with her arms, now on one side, now on the other, and Porpoise, always a leap behind or a leap to this side or to that, struggled after her. They crossed the open ground beyond the camp and disappeared in the forest. Tanana Station waited for their reappearance. Long and without success, they waited. During this time, Akun ate and slept. He waited much of the time where the steamboat landed, not hearing the words which were said about him because he did nothing. A day later, Porpoise returned. He was tired and bad-tempered. He spoke to no one but Akun and tried to quarrel with him. But Akun walked away. Porpoise did not waste time. He hired a half a dozen young men and went into the forest with them. The next day, the steamboat Seattle stopped at the shore. When she departed again, Akun was employed on the boat. Not many hours afterward, when it was his duty to guide the steamboat, he saw a small boat coming from the shore. There was only one person in it. He studied it carefully and slowed the big boat's speed. The captain came in.
"What's the trouble?" he demanded. "The water is good here."
Akun made no answer. He saw a larger boat leaving the bank, and in it were several persons. He turned the wheel of the steamboat toward the smaller boat. The captain was angered.
"It is only a woman," he protested.
Akun did not reply. He looked only at the woman and the boat following her.
"You will drive the steamboat on the shore,"
the captain protested, seizing the wheel. But Akun applied his strength to the wheel and looked directly into the captain's eyes. The captain slowly released the wheel. Akun held the Seattle steady until he saw the woman's fingers grasp the forward rail. Then he signaled for full speed ahead. The large boat was very near, but the space between it and the steamboat was widening. The woman laughed and leaned over the rail.
"Then catch me, Porpoisetook!"
she cried. Ahkoon left the steamboat at Fort Yukon. He purchased a small boat and went up the Porcupine River, and with him went El Su. It was a difficult journey, but Ahkoon had traveled it before. When they came to the headwaters of the Porcupine, they left the boat and went on foot across the Rocky Mountains. Ahkoon greatly liked to walk behind El Su and watch her movement. There was a music in it that he loved, and especially he loved the well-rounded legs and the small moccasined feet that never tired. "You are light as air," he said, looking up at her. "It is no labor for you to walk. You almost float, so lightly do your feet rise and fall." And El Su bent and kissed Ahkoon. "When we reach the Mackenzie River, we will not delay," Ahkoon said later. "We will go south before the winter catches us. We will go to the Sunlands where there is no snow. But we will return. I have seen much of the world, and there is no land like Alaska. There is no sun like our sun, and the snow is good after the long summer."
"And you will learn to read," said El Su.
And Ahkoon said, "I will surely learn to read." But there was a delay when they reached the Mackenzie. They joined a group of Mackenzie Indians. When they were hunting, there was an accident in which Ahkoon was shot. His right arm was broken and his shoulder was hurt. Ahkoon knew something about medicine, as did El Su. Ahkoon lay by the fire to rest, so the bones would become strong again. It was then that Porpoisetook, with his six young men, arrived. Ahkoon was still weak, and he appealed to the Mackenzies, but Porpoisetook made his demands, and the Mackenzies did not know how to settle the problem. Porpoisetook wanted to seize El Su, but this they would not permit. Judgment must be given. Because it was an affair of man and woman, the council of old men was gathered. They had been selected so that judgment might not be given by the young men, who were warm of heart. The old men sat in a circle about the fire. Their faces were lean and old, and they breathed heavily. The smoke was not good for them. Occasionally they struck at the insects that flew into the warmth of the fire. After such effort, they coughed painfully. Some of them coughed blood. One of them sat a little apart, with head bent forward, and blood flowed slowly from his mouth. They were like dead men. Their time was short. It was a judgment of the dead.
"And I paid for her a heavy price," Porpoisetook concluded. "Such a price you have never seen. Sell all that is yours. Sell your spears and guns. Sell your furs. Sell your tents and boars and dogs. Sell everything, and you will not have $1,000. Yet I gave for the woman El Su 26 times the price of all your spears and guns, your furs and your tents and boats and dogs. It was a heavy price."
The old men nodded, although they wondered that any woman should be worth such a price. The one from whose mouth blood flowed wiped his lips.
"Is it true?"
he asked each of Porpoisetook's six young men, and each answered that it was true.
"Is it true?"
he asked El Su, and she answered,
"It is true."
"But Porpoisetook has not told that he is an old man," Ahkoon said, "and that he has daughters older than El Su."
"It is true. Porpoisetook is an old man," said El Su.
"It is for Porpoisetook to measure," the strength of his age,
said he on whose mouth were drops of blood.
We are old men. Behold, age is never so old as youth would measure it.
And the circle of old men nodded their agreement and coughed.
I told him that I would never be his wife, said Elsu.
Yet you took from him 26 times the value of all that we possess?
Asked a one-eyed old man. Elsu was silent.
Is it true?
His one eye stared at her.
It is true,
she said.
But I will run again,
she cried a moment later.
Always, I will run away.
That is for Porpoise to consider, said another of the old men. It is for us to consider the judgment. What price did you pay for her?
Was demanded of Akun. No price did I pay for her, he answered. She was above price. I did not measure her in gold dust, nor in dogs and tents and furs. The old men talked together. These old men are like ice, Akun said in English. I will not listen to their judgment, Porpoise. If you take Elsu, I will surely kill you. The old men stopped talking and looked at him uneasily.
We do not know the language you speak, one said. He said that he would kill me, Porpoise told them. So it would be well to take his gun from him, and to have some of your young men sit by him so he may not harm me. He is a young man, and what are broken bones to youth?
Akun, lying helpless, had gun and knife taken from him, and beside each of his shoulders sat young men of the Mackenzies. The one-eyed old man stood up.
We are surprised at the price paid for one mere woman, he began. But the price is no concern of ours. We are here to give judgment, and judgment we give. We have no doubt. It is known to all that Porpoise paid a heavy price for the woman, Elsu. Therefore does the woman Elsu belong to Porpoise and none other.
He sat down heavily and coughed. The old men nodded and coughed.
I will kill you, Akun cried in English.
Porpoise smiled and stood up.
You have given true judgment, he said to the council, and my young men will give you much tobacco. Now, let the woman be brought to me.
Akun bit his lip. The young men took Elsu by the arms. She did not struggle and was led to Porpoise.
Sit there at my feet until I have spoken, he commanded.
He paused a moment.
It is true, he said. I am an old man, yet I can understand the ways of youth. The fire has not all gone out of me. Yet I am no longer young, nor am I about to run on these old legs of mine through all the years that remain to me. Elsu can run fast and well. This I know, for I have seen and run after her. It is not good that a wife should run so fast. I paid for her a heavy price, yet she runs away from me. Akun paid no price at all, yet she runs to him. When I came among you people of the Mackenzie, I was of one opinion. As I listened in the council and thought of the speed of the legs of Elsu, I had many different opinions. Now I am of one opinion again, but it is a different one from the one I brought to the council. Let me tell you my opinion. When a dog runs away once from a master, it will run again. It does not matter how many times it is brought home. Each time it will run away again. When we have such dogs, we sell them. El Su is like a dog that runs away. I will sell her. Is there any man of the council that will buy?
The old men coughed and remained silent.
Akun would buy, Porpoisetuk continued, but he has no money. So, I give El Su to him, as he said, without price. Even now I will give her to him.
Reaching down, he took El Su by the hand and led her across the space to where Akun lay on his back.
She has a bad habit, Akun, he said, seating her at Akun's feet. She has run away from me in the past. In the days to come, she may run away from you. But there is no need to fear that she will ever run away, Akun. I shall see to that. Never will she run away from you. You have the promise of Porpoisetuk. She has great wit, I know, for often I have felt its bite. Yet I will show my wit for once, and by my wit I will secure her to you, Akun.
Bending over, Porpoisetuk crossed El Su's feet. Then, before his purpose could be guessed, he raised his gun and shot her through both feet. As Akun struggled to rise against the weight of the young men, there was heard the sound of his broken bone, rebroken.
"It is just," said the old men, one to another.
El Su made no sound. She sat and looked at her destroyed feet on which she would never walk again. "My legs are strong, El Su," Akun said. "But never will they carry me away from you." El Su looked at him, and for the first time in all the time he had known her, Akun saw tears in her eyes.
"Is it just?"
Porpoisetuk asked and stood laughing as he prepared to depart.
"It is just,"
the old men said, and they continued sitting silently.